You begin to see as you travel to different places that there's not a universal way to define the American experience.
There's a lot of disillusionment and a lot of despair because we really don't have a middle class anymore.
Everybody is spinning a story in some way, shape, or form.
Nothing in life happens for absolutely no reason.
Being queer is extremely joyful and generally involves a huge community of your chosen family.
We want to erase a lot of times how this country came to be.
Hello, and welcome to Unpacking America, Season 3, kicking off today. My name is John David Easling, and as always, it is a pleasure to have you here. Whether you are a returning listener or a first-time listener, this series is going to be an absolute treat for you. We get into some of the biggest issues that I personally think are facing America at the moment. If you're new to the series, the show, the premise is essentially a bewildered Australian man trying to make sense of the absolute chaos that he's found himself in living in America and listening to and sharing stories with people who've grown up in this wonderful country, their experiences, their points of views, and finding some common ground between them. Astute listeners will have noticed that this episode is titled What Hill Are You Willing to Die On? Part 1. Yes, it is our first two-part episode. I am joined by the enigmatic Anthony Highland, a motivational speaker, a spoken word artist, a massive online influencer and presence, and an author. And he and I will cover a wide range of topics in this two-part special, not least of which is how we disseminate information online, the power that social media and social media influencers have over the masses, and what role information and disinformation currently plays in American society. So this episode is huge. It's broken up into two 45-minute parts. At the end of each episode, I will discuss where you can find Anthony's work outside of this podcast and the wonderful things that he is doing online and where you can follow him. But please sit back, relax, and join me as we get into the first chapter of Season 3 of Unpacking America. What hill are you willing to die on? All right, Anthony, thank you so much for joining me on Unpacking America today, man. It's really good to have you on the show.
Awesome. Glad to be here. Thank you so much.
So I like to always begin the episode with talking to folks about where they grew up, what part of the U.S., and what that experience was like.
Oh, absolutely. Again, thank you so much for allowing me to come on. I like to think of people's platforms as their classroom, as a former teacher. You know, you don't just put anyone in front of your students. So I appreciate that opportunity to speak to your audience. Anthony Highland grew up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in the United States. My grandmother raised me and my five brothers, the six of us in total. My mother had some substance abuse issues that she has since overcome. She has been clean for over 15 years. I'm, you know, ridiculously proud of her. Persevering through high school, had some trials and tribulations there, dealt with some abuse, foster care, a lot of different things that when it comes to your adolescence that you don't really anticipate. I subsequently ended up getting a full four-year academic scholarship to college. I went to Voorhees College, which is now Voorhees University in South Carolina. Graduated from there. I went on to become a sixth and seventh grade English teacher, to whereby that was very short lived due to a great deal of racism, to whereby I enlisted in the United States Navy, which I've been for almost the last decade.
Yeah, wow. That's a lot to unpack just in a nutshell right there, right?
Indeed.
I mean, just being one of six brothers is a hell of an experience growing up with. I mean, I'm an only child, so I have the complete opposite experience, right? And like a lot of Americans, it sounds like you've sort of traveled the country and lived in a lot of different states and moved around a little bit.
Oh, indeed. It didn't kind of get really as like stringent until I got older and joined the military. I kind of stayed on the East Coast between Pennsylvania, Maryland, and South Carolina for the most part until I joined the military. Then I got the unique opportunity to go live in Hawaii for 3 years. And that was definitely an eye opener, and just learning the history and the culture there, to where by now I've returned to Virginia, where my first duty station was.
So your first sort of aspirations from leaving school, though, was to go and teach. And I'm wondering, was that, because I mean, teaching and military service is kind of, they're both calls of duty in a sense. And they're both, in my opinion, really quite noble professions to pursue. So was there always something in you that wanted to give back or to serve?
Absolutely. Education has always been the foundation of everything that I sought to do. One of the things my grandmother taught us as children is that, you know, people can take a lot of things from you, but what they can't take is what you've learned, your education, your basis. And when you're passionate about something, the goal in it is to learn as much as you can about it. So that it's almost like the age old adage, you know, when you love what you do, it's never a job. It's almost like you're just living life really and truly. And for me, I think that the will to serve has always been embedded in me. My grandmother, she had us in the church. And one of her requirements for us to exist in that space was to be active. And we started off in the church choir. I realized very quickly that was not my ministry. Then I went to being a usher, and I realized again, that was not my ministry. And I just really sat down with her, and I was just trying to figure out, like, how best can I serve while being here and still utilizing my gifts, talents, and abilities to not feel like this is just a place that I go every Sunday. So they opened up an opportunity for youth leaders. And pretty much what it was in a nutshell is you were able to lead some of the youth worship services as well as some of the after-school program activities as well. And that's where I saw myself leading at the other young people, essentially. And I just have a will, like you said, a will to serve. And that's how best I could see my talents and abilities being utilized in order to advance not just the church, but our youth department as a whole.
But it sounds like that youth role then took you into teaching.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely, it was a great segue. I also joined the after-school program as one of the lead tutors for that program. And ironically enough, I tutored English. It's always been a passion of mine. I'm also a writer, spoken word artist, and performer outside of my professional public speaking that I do as well. So that was an area, again, that I saw that I could serve while also simultaneously earning some income. So I worked for my church as a youth mentor for the after school, youth tutor for our summer program, our summer component. And that was an eye-opening experience in and of itself. Then to go from that to an actual classroom full of students, it was almost like a full circle moment for me. And sometimes I look back and I just think to myself, what if conditions would have been different during that time period? Would I still be in the classroom? And I truly do believe that nothing in life happens for absolutely no reason. Like, everything has a reason, regardless of whether you agree with it or not. For me, going into social media was my way of going from small student base classroom to now I have a global classroom, because my biggest platform, which is, you know, my TikTok, I have 1.5 million supporters. They're international, you know, and to know that there are people in other countries that are learning from the information that I'm putting out as it relates to building your platform, different leadership skills, perseverance, self-confidence, things of that nature. Sometimes we take this idea that our experiences are just unique to our own geographical location, to whereby we can utilize the gifts that we have in order to reach a broader audience.
Yeah, you're not wrong. I mean, 1.5 million people, that's sort of the size of a small country as well, which is a nice nice way to look at the size of your classroom. It's interesting. I'd like to, like, I do want to really leap into this a little bit more, but before we do, I just want to sort of talk about what was the moment or the event that sort of led you to realize that teaching wasn't for you?
for interest of not saying names, but sake of anonymity.
Oh, yeah, no names, no names.
I had a principal that was just, I call it covert racism. There's some that are overt, that are like right in your face. And then there are some that are covert. Being the only Black male teacher in the building that was younger, there were a lot of policies that were implemented solely because of me, in terms of dress code, in terms of facial grooming and things of that nature. And I didn't see it as being fair. I didn't see it as being ethical. And I would call it out. And one of the things about that is when you're not the dominant voice in the space, sometimes you can get drowned out. And it was at that moment that I realized, with minimal support from not just the school, but from the organization that brought me to the school for the 2-year commitment that I had there, I wasn't even receiving support on that level. So in my mind, I'm thinking it's almost the same as going into almost like survival mode, right? When I left a home my senior year in high school, I left with the clothes on my back and the suitcase full of everything that I owned. And that's not an exaggeration. I didn't have like a room to go back to at my grandma's house, because my other brothers, they still had to persevere through school and things of that nature. And, you know, it being 6 of us in total, 5 when I graduated, somebody else had to step into that space. So for me, it's always just been about making it happen with what I have. Same thing present day, you know, as I sit almost 10 years of being in the military, everything that is in my home right now is what I own. And some things that I've carried with me, I have a trophy from 2010, my senior year, outstanding student athlete. I graduated a valedictorian of my high school. However, I also ran track, and I still have that trophy. That trophy is older than all 3 of my kids. But it was something that from my senior year in high school, going all the way through college, teaching, going all the way through my tenure here in the military and my continued career, I've still kept that trophy. And that's just one of the things that I've kept, because again, I'm operating under this mindset of I have what I own. So in that, I had to figure out, okay, what am I going to do? The military for me, honestly, was like a rite of passage. So the breakdown of my brothers, I have 3 older brothers and 2 younger brothers. All 3 of my older brothers, Army. My youngest brother, he was Army as well. However, he departed a little bit earlier. And my younger brother than me, he is a model. So for me, the military, uncle in the Air Force, grandfather in the Navy, things of that nature, I found out. It was just like, I knew I was going to join the military. I just didn't know what branch.
Mm-hmm.
Going through that situation at that school accelerated that. And initially, it's funny, people ask me all the time, well, what made you join the Navy? And I always tell them, well, the Air Force didn't pick the phone up.
Yeah, right.
And it was, you know, one of those things that it was a decision that I decided to make. The Navy guy was there, and I had a really down to earth conversation with him. And I was like, this is what I want to do. So that was the turning point for me, not just because I'm a firm believer in advocacy. And I do my best, even through my writing, to speak for those whom can't speak for themselves. And when I know for a fact something that's taking place is wrong, I'm going to call it out. Now, granted, we recognize that you have to use tact when doing so, because you can't just be, you know, outrightly being disrespectful to your superiors. You just can't do that. However, there is a professional way of getting your point across. However, consistently being dismissed was definitely not in the cards for me, especially when I knew what was happening was wrong.
Well, I think one of the saddest things about that is that there's so few male teachers out there at the moment, like role modeling for kids, and Black teachers as well. From friends of mine in the US, yep, the teachers, there's so few. So, you know, I have Black friends who, you know, only had like 1 Black teacher at high school.
Same.
That's about one. Yeah.
And I still talk to them to this day.
Nice. But then, you know, so you have, you know, people teaching Black history that don't have that context, right, to Black students. Mm-hmm. And it's sad. All that is to say is that experience for you sucks, and that's sad. But, you know, I would hope that things continue to change and we do see more diversity in teaching across the US, because genuinely, like you said, for me, education is super important, and it's one of the things I see America really failing its students in at the moment.
Oh, absolutely. And I could definitely see myself returning later on down the line, more than likely on the collegiate level as opposed to the high school level. And, you know, I always want to make sure I give a huge shout out to educators worldwide. And you hit the nail right on the head. That was one of the things that I struggled with from that standpoint of, like, we already don't have enough. And here you are, great example, great role model, and now you're about to exit as well. So I had to ask myself, okay, well, how best am I still going to be able to affect that change that I want to see? I said, okay, I'll start coaching. So then I did that for a little bit. I coached middle school football for a little bit. And then, like I said, I joined the military, so I was a little bit removed from that. However, there are opportunities within the military for those openings. You know, if, of course, if you have the time, I have a mentor that literally coaches softball and baseball at his daughter's school, and he's full-time in the Navy. You know, now, of course, when he's out to sea, someone takes the mantle for him, but those opportunities are still there.
So for you joining the Navy, I mean, I like the Air Force didn't pick up the phone, but that was obviously the number one choice. What was the role that you took on when you joined the Navy?
So I became what's known as a boatswain's mate. Right now, I'm a boatswain's mate second class. A little bit about what we do sort of stems around basic construction and shipboard handling, which is short for shipboard driving. So when the ship gets underway and or goes out to sea, my job drives the ship. When you're looking at a vessel and you see those lines coming from the ship to the pier, my job does that. When you see the anchor drop from the ship, my job does that. When you see ships out to sea and they're like alongside one another and they're like hoses going back and forth between the two ships and almost like they're on a steady pace with one another, my job does that as well. And actually, a bit of a dope addendum to that, I got the opportunity to qualify. So a regular shipboard driver is called a helmsman. However, there's also opportunity for you to become what's called a master helmsman, to which I qualified to become. As a master helmsman, what you're essentially doing is driving during the most dangerous of evolutions. So by evolutions, I mean scenarios that could very well freak out the average ship driver. So when I went on my first deployment, crossing to go overseas towards the Middle East, toward that region, we kind of were off the coast of Djibouti, Africa. That's kind of like the region that we sailed to. Myself and my counterpart pretty much drove almost that entire way, because the shipboard conditions of the open ocean, they're a lot different than being in the channel of your naval station. The conditions are way different. The ship rocks, the ship rolls, big waves crashing on, you know, the ship, and you still have to maintain a certain rudder, a certain speed, you know, in the water and things of that nature. And these are all things that you're thinking about. However, for me, it was just about the passion of the adventure. And I think that was something that kind of drove me to get that qualification. And it was something that made me love my job a little bit more.
Yeah, right. I mean, that sounds like a full-on job, right?
Indeed.
Yeah, indeed. Like driving warships through storms and things sounds hectic, to say the least. But I also, like, I don't know. I got really I was absorbed in that story, man. I was imagining the visuals. It's really cool. And I guess you're sort of watching the news pretty closely at the moment, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I do my best also, too, because I do have a degree in communications. My concentration was public speaking and journalism. So in that, there are things that I pay attention to that the average person probably wouldn't, just to kind of see those trends, to kind of see, like, okay, where are the consistencies, where are the inconsistencies, and really and truly the idea of the dissemination of information is really and truly the age that we're in now, especially as it relates to social media. You know, what image is being put out there? What story is being told? What narrative is being pushed? And these are things to be careful on, especially as it relates to how you navigate your space, not just as an individual, but also as a professional. Because, you know, people hearing their viewpoints on certain things, given the space that you're in, sometimes you don't get that grace.
Spot on. You've made some, like, there's like three things you've said there that I kind of want to capture on. But I mean, like, this kind of world we're living in at the moment, as you said, where information is really difficult to disseminate. I don't do too much on TikTok, I'll be honest, but sort of lurking around on Twitter and Reddit and all of the others, just listening to people hour by hour, changing their stories, changing their opinions.
Mm-hmm.
That is something I find really interesting about your sort of your role as a spokesperson or as a social media influencer, in how you right. make sure that what you're saying is legitimate.
I watched an interview with Denzel Washington. He said, what's the long-term effects of too much information? And sometimes it's the need to be first, not necessarily the need to be right.
Mm.
And one of the things that I take with me, I actually did my senior year in college, I did my senior thesis on social media's impact on journalism. And what you'll come to find is that, unironically, there are a lot of outlets that would prefer to put a story out first as opposed to just being right. So one of the things that I pride myself on with my platform is ensuring that I have all of my receipts, all of my facts, all of my dates, all of my statistics, all of those things. And if I'm going to quote something, ensure that I can back it up. Now, if it has since been updated, we can hold space for that, and I can acknowledge that. Because there are people out there that will nitpick and scrutinize every single thing that you do. And the larger your voice becomes, the more eyes that are on you. We are in the age of social media. And in that, the idea of controlling the narrative as an influencer, you have to be aware of that. Now, granted, does everyone take the role and or responsibility the same? No, they do not. Should they? Sure. Absolutely, they should. However, what you also have to do is you have to take what comes along with that as well, providing you decide to go against that grain and or put out information, especially knowingly that is of a false nature. And I do my absolute darndest not to do that. So if someone corrects me, I'm not too prideful that I can't acknowledge that.
It's definitely refreshing to hear anybody admit that that they made a mistake and are prepared to go back on it. Because I think, as well as like you say, the people who are prepared to try and put the story out first, not necessarily a story out right, they're also not prepared to walk back the story when it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the trend that I see, particularly in sort of what I would call mainstream media. Mm-hmm. Which obviously includes Fox as well. I know there's always people sort of saying, "Oh, it's mainstream media."
I can't stand Fox News.
Well,
Lord have mercy.
I went to the gym a few weeks ago, and I don't know if the manager was off duty or something, but someone had just put Fox News on every single one of the TVs. So you're on you're at the treadmill. It's just 8 Fox News TVs, and I was so close to just getting off the treadmill and just switching them all off. And I was like, nah, someone's going to kick off. I don't want to be aggressive, but at the same time, like, I don't want this shit on my screen.
Facts. Hey, listen, that's when you pop the headphones in and you just, I got the eye of the tiger. Absolutely. And you know what? You also bring up a good point. The question sometimes isn't always in what are you putting out. Sometimes it's a matter of what are you consuming? We have to get away from this idea that everyone knows that what these outlets are doing is wrong. There are some people that will live and die by a news station because of this desire. So one of the things that I also do, which I think aided me a great deal in building my platform on social media, is that I study it. And one of the tenets of social media, what it does for an individual, outside of the consistent hits of oxytocin that it provides for you, the serotonin releases, essentially the feel-good hormone, when you put out a certain group of information or a certain pamphlet of information, so to speak, and there are people that engage with it, right? There's also the negative feeling attached to the idea of walking back a story or admitting a mistake or acknowledge an inadequacy that exists among the information in which you've put out. So in that, most people, it's almost like I'd rather ask for forgiveness than permission, right? I don't want to ask your permission to put out the right information. I'm just going to put the story out. And then if I get something wrong, just please forgive me. You only get so much grace in that regard before it becomes a pattern. And now you're not even being trusted at all, to the point where now adjustments have to be made. And people don't readily want to admit their mistakes. There's a certain release that comes along with leasing out that responsibility to consume information. So that sounds like word salad. I trust, metaphorically, of course, because I don't trust Fox News. I trust, this is like the person that trusts Fox News, that Fox News is putting out the most accurate information, because in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, why would they not? So I'm going to live and die by whatever they put out in the manner in which they put it out. So if someone brings me rival information in the absence of the same perceived factual context, I'm going to have a leg to stand on to argue with them, because they don't have their facts and their sources ready. This is where I come in, me personally. This is how I've built my platform. I've looked at the individuals that will perpetuate a Fox News narrative, and then I'll actually go and look the story up, look up the facts of the story, and then I'll put that person's argument in the forefront, and then I'll rip it apart point by point by point by point, and giving the actual factual information and factual context. And then just kind of question, why would you knowingly put this information out there, knowing that it was of a false nature? And most oftentimes they don't have a rebuttal. They'll go directly to personal insults and or threats of physical violence.
Do threats of violence come through a lot?
Yes. Yes, they do. Probably more than social media influencers like to acknowledge. It's not the pretty part of social media, especially when you do long form content. And or for myself, I've been an activist since I was a teenager. So taking that activism to social media, there are people that are going to disagree with you. Now, I truly do believe that disagreements have their place. However, once violence gets attached to it, or the perceived nature of violence or threats of violence, I do believe that a reevaluation has to take place as well, as it relates to how you're putting out information, maintaining anonymity with your location, you know, where you live and things of that nature. Are you familiar with doxing?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Let's maybe tease that out for listeners though as well, like a definition of doxing.
Okay. So doxing is short for document dropping. And essentially what it is the public divulgence of private information for all intents and purposes, nefarious means. For example, let's say you put a post up on social media and I say, hey, I don't like what you put out on social media. I'm going to, quote, dox you. So I'm going to look up your private information and I find out, oh, you work at Advanced Auto Parts on 1414. I'm looking at one of my hazard signs, 1414 Child Hazard Lane. And I put that information out. I've now doxed your work address, where you work at. So now what subsequently ends up happening is all of the people that agree with that individual, now they're rating that location one star on Yelp. They're calling the manager, trying to get you fired. And ironically enough, I've had firsthand experience with that. I've had people file formal complaints with the United States Navy, all because I said their name in a video. Not that I've done anything wrong, just that I've said their name in a video and they didn't like it, and literally demanded a public apology.
So does your, this is actually one of the questions I sort of was thinking of as we've been talking, is like, does your position within the Navy come at a, what is it a juxtaposition to your position as a social media influencer?
I used to think when I first joined it would be. However, what it boils down to is, like I mentioned earlier, what are you doing? For me, I pride myself on ensuring that I'm disseminating factual information. So in the event that someone were to attempt to try and, for all intents and purposes, damage my military career because of my social media, they would have to prove to my command that, number one, I've violated our UCMJ, which is the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is essentially our military law. And they will have to prove in that video what I said was wrong. I do my absolute darndest to get primary sources. So if a person actually said something out of their mouth, I'm putting that in the video. If they type something in the comment section, I'm putting that in the video. If there's an article out there, a factual .org, .edu, .gov, I'm putting that information in there. So there's context to what it is that I'm saying. You may just not like it and your feelings are hurt. And we can acknowledge that. Okay, your feelings are hurt. That's fine. However, what that doesn't mean is that I was wrong because your feelings were hurt.
And what was the response when you got doxxed and there was a movement to get you expelled from the U.S. Navy? What was the response from your superiors?
Many of them, and this is, again, man, you're asking all the great questions. It's actually something that I'm working on because they supported me. And it was because, again, I had facts on my side. I made sure that nothing I said went against our social media guidelines. I tell service members this all the time, especially if you're going to be an influencer on social media. Make sure you are reading the social media guidelines of your service component. Every single organization has one. The Navy, the Marines, the Air Force, the Army, the Coast Guard, even the Space Force has a social media policy because that's the age that we're in. And you have to ensure that you remember that even when I take my uniform off, I'm still a member. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I have to ensure that when they make these calls or they try and report me for whatever the case may be, the question then becomes, where was I wrong? And then I typically, and it's got to a point now where I'll just go ahead and give my chain of command a heads up. If I see my comment section going a certain way, I don't mind cutting my comments off. Yeah. If, you know, a certain person is harassing me a lot, I'll go ahead and let them know preemptively just to kind of get ahead of that. Because these are things that, again, while I'm in the right, eventually what it becomes is a nuisance. Nobody wants to be known as the troublemaker.
Well, I would imagine they're more concerned with, you know, if you're giving away military secrets or
right, you know, things or like that. Violating, yeah, you know, military law.
Sure, that's a different story.
You know, somebody's butthurt feelings because you mentioned their name in a video.
Yeah. Yeah, there's very little seeking to understand. I mean, globally at the moment, but I look at America as this... So a little context for yourself. I arrived here in August of 2020. And mm-hmm. when I so I'd come from I'd come from Australia, you know, so
that's a rough time to be coming to America.
I think that the penny just dropped right
the thick of it.
2 months after George Floyd, right in the middle of COVID, and a few months ahead of the notorious 2020 election. So, and I know we're not going to talk politics and get into all that stuff. All I'm doing is, I guess, setting up the time frame that I arrived in. And for me, the more I spoke to Americans my wife and I sort of did a road trip twice from West Coast California all the way through to Chicago down into her hometown in Indiana. So I've traveled through about 22 states, and I talk to people whenever I can because this country fascinates me. But it's the people in the US that view their fellow citizens as enemies that I find the most alarming, but also the most intriguing, where I'm just like, this is a very alien thing for me as an Australian. This inability to seek to understand, you know, not another country, not another you know, for like just like literally just your neighbors sometimes. It feels like it's kind of lost. And it feels like there's almost a cultural civil war taking place in the US at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think also, too, like just the idea of just talking to people. Sometimes it's as simple as, how are you doing? Most oftentimes, I've started making it my practice to ask that question twice, because most people are conditioned to give you a blanketed answer because they already don't think that you care. So most people, when you say, hey, man, how's it going? Oh, I'm quite all right. But then you ask that follow up question, but are you really? And then they'll take that moment to reflect like, nah, actually, I'm not, because they want to safeguard that emotion because they're not sure that that space actually exists in order for them to be vulnerable and or in order for them to get that healing that they're seeking. So I do my best to ensure that I think outside myself and more so live outside of myself, because when we shackle ourselves to our own expectations and or our own experiences and never allow ourselves to even conceptualize a difference of opinion and or a different viewpoint, we really and truly, we limit ourselves and we limit our audience, and simultaneously, those that look up to us are being stifled. Because now you're not getting that diverse view of those experiences. You're only operating on your own.
Interestingly, what you've just sort of said really feels like a very Christian, to me, like a true Christian view of the world, right? Or looking at a society. And that's what I keep seeing as being missing from a lot of the current teachings in the US, like, that ability to connect, that ability to show compassion, which I feel is the missing piece. Certainly my experience with like the Baptist churches and things like that is that compassion seems to be, again, a dying art or a dying value.
Oh, absolutely. Not even just that, but just the sheer compassion for one another. We're living in such a desensitized society that people just want, they just want their voices being heard. And sometimes it doesn't matter who they have to step on in order for that voice to be heard. And that's therein lies one of the biggest atrocities that we can commit, not just as influencers and or as people, but just as human beings as a whole. It's not just about you. And many times we're conditioned to believe that. Now, don't get me wrong. There are opportunities for us to prioritize self. I will never tell someone not to do that. However, when it comes to the worldview as a whole, and when we talk about technological advances, economic advances, archaeological advances, architectural advances, et cetera, we have to think outside of ourselves. Because when we don't, you can clearly see where the intention lies with the decisions that people make, especially those in those positions to make those decisions.
Is that how you sort of want to see your, like, the way you're using your social media platform? Does that's the sort of thing you want to be an activist against or for, rather, I should say? Or
oh, absolutely. I'm a firm believer in it. Really and truly, it boils down to this question. My grandmother used to ask us as teenagers, if the whole world was blind, how many people would you impress?
Huh.
And it has very little to do. And of course, you know, given my responsibility on social media, I recognize that, you know, ableism exists and things of that nature. Right. So this is not a hit against, you know, those whom are blind. It's just more so you asking the question of, if couldn't nobody see you, would you still be able to impact the world with what it is that you're doing? Now, granted, we recognize that some gifts aren't always visual. Some gifts aren't always auditory. The whole idea is to make you think about, what contribution are you leaving this world? When you take your final breath, whenever that may be, what do you want to be remembered for? And for me, it has always been the guy who spoke for those whom couldn't speak for themselves, the guy who did his due diligence to ensure that those voices were not only heard, but also prioritized, and in a way that was different than most.
That's really interesting, because I mean, I think your grandmother, like, just from the three or four pearls of wisdom you've dropped from her in this conversation, sounds like an incredible woman. But I guess, like, for me, that's kind of where I want this podcast to go as well, right? It's talking to not a politician, not a celebrity, not anybody. I mean, you've probably got the biggest reach of anybody I've spoken to so far, but talking to, like, you know, what is it like to grow up as an Indigenous American living in, you know, Southern California on land that, you know, used to be your ancestral land and is now a mini mall. You know, those are stories that we don't hear enough of. So celebrating marginalized voices is an incredibly powerful thing. And I think that's a wonderful use of a platform.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, what you sum it up to is the responsibility that you have. Every time, you know, I turn on my microphone, every time I turn on my camera, every time I step into, you know, my room, I talked to you earlier about my office. That is my literal creative space. Every time I cross the threshold of that, I ask myself, where does my responsibility start? And it starts long before you turn that camera on, long before you charge up that wireless microphone, long before you turn on that ring light, long before you set that tripod up. It's when you sit down and you brainstorm what those ideas are, because now you have an opportunity to address a lot of the issues you could potentially face before you face them. Now, I'm just going to be honest with you. Some things are inevitable. If there's anything the past decade of being in the military has taught me, is that there will always be one. You can't please everybody. However, if you know that what you're producing is of quality, is of a factual basis, and you stand on it, I ask my mentees this question all the time. What hill are you willing to die on? Is that the hill that you're willing to die on? No? Okay, well then retract that statement. Apologize. Acknowledge the harm that you've done. Oh, you don't want to apologize. Okay. Well, there's also some things that are going to come along with that too. And you got to be willing to go through that as well. You can't just take the good, 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 the good. Life doesn't work like that. Life is like a roller coaster. I know we hear this all the time. People talk about the highs and lows, right? But what people don't talk about is the mechanics that go into the process long before you even get on the roller coaster. That's the part that I focus on. I focus on long before you even consume my content. Am I thinking about doing essentially a walkthrough, right? I just love metaphors. So with this roller coaster, I think about, like, okay, am I walking through? Am I making sure all of the nuts are tight? Am I running diagnostic? The night before, did we do enough tests? Did we, you know, run the apparatus that the person is going to get on, whether it's a swing, whether it's a coaster, whether it's a log, whatever it is? Did we run it through in its entirety? Then did we analyze every single point of breakage, every single point of something that could be loose? And, you know, sometimes we see these videos on social media of, like, a person is, like, underneath a coaster and they'll hear, like, Ricky, Ricky, Ricky. And they're like, this is probably not safe. What that is it's telling you, like, hey, it's not a problem right now, but it could very well become a problem very soon. And then we see, you know, unfortunately, you know, these tragic, you know, losses of life, to whereby if someone would have paid attention to those nuts that needed to be tightened up, or to that slither of track that was rusted because of whatever environmental condition that took place, they would have been able to catch that to prevent that loss of life. For me, it's being able to catch as many things to prevent the spreading, the continued spreading of misinformation and disinformation as a source of news and or awareness.
And is that the hill you're willing to die on?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. I will die on that hill, standing by myself, holding the flag by myself. Factual information, oh, I'm going toe-to-toe with you, and all you got is misinformation and talking points, I'm going to chew you up and spit you out every single time. And then I'm going to have you so discombobulated, you're going to have to explain to your audience why you thought that was a good idea to do. Because again, you got to think about, this is a principle that I take with me on my platform. It's impact versus intent. The intent that you posted that with does not include the impact that it has. Mm. So your intention was to rile people up. the impact that you had is that you inadvertently caused a war. Again, is that the hill that you're willing to die on? Because you know, long before you put that information out, that you're putting out false information. So the question then becomes, is that the hill you're willing to die on? And for me, going against misinformation campaigns, going against, essentially, I call it social media propaganda. It's not necessarily, oh, it has to be news. It has to be current events. It could literally be a historical happening. Mm. And someone just knowingly spreads misinformation. It's just like, no, absolutely not. That's wrong. But do it in a way that's digestible, but that also teaches other people in the process.
Well, that's not even limited to social media anymore, right? Like, I mean,
right.
One of the things that I've talked about on this podcast quite a lot is, so my university degree, my thesis is in history. And when you start to deliberately teach incorrect facts to kids about the way a country was founded, or, you know, I'm not talking about like certain dates or certain names, but you know what I'm talking about. Like,
mm-hmm.
That's beyond just like propaganda. That's full blown grooming and conditioning. You know, I mean, an example that's not as close to home is, you know, China's history books currently are teaching kids at school that Britain didn't have a lease on Hong Kong for 100 years. It was always in Chinese hands. Now, outside of looking in, that doesn't seem so dangerous. But it's just like, that's a tipping point of like, well, what are you teaching that's completely untrue to an entire generation of kids? And what I worry about for the States is you'll have people growing up in California who have a very different view of how the country was founded and what its values are than you might in, say, Florida. And I'm using these two as sort of puffed up archetypes, but, you know, state by state, curriculum by curriculum, these things are different. And so it's not just misinformation across social media platforms now. It almost seems to me to be like a full-blown indoctrination.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're not careful, you will fall into the pitfalls of doing that. I call it the era of shock value content, to whereby you have people like, for example, one of the most tumultuous examples that I could give you is that for someone to hop on social media and say, racism is a myth. It doesn't exist. You're just too emotional. We already know that is factually incorrect. Now, regardless of how you express that, it is a factually incorrect statement. That person knows that they're going to elicit and or evoke a specific emotional response from a marginalized group of people. And the more, unfortunately, the more clicks something has, the more comments something has, what it tells the algorithm to do is to push it because it's receiving engagement, regardless of whether it's helpful or harmful. And the reason why I say you got to be careful is because if your numbers aren't looking a certain way and you see the person that's doing that shock value type of content and they're getting those consistent numbers, they're consistently going viral, and all you're motivated by is those numbers, you'll be like, well, I might as well do that too, because this person is going viral consistently and da-da-da-da-da-da. The question then becomes, what are you really producing? Because that model doesn't last very long. That model, there's no longevity in misinformation or disinformation campaigns. They come to a head eventually. And the results aren't typically sustainable and or satisfying. They're temporary dopamine hits. Most people don't know this, and I'm not sure if you're aware of this. Social media platforms literally hire narcotics experts to make their platforms as addicting as possible.
Yeah, right. I mean, I didn't know that, but I'm also not surprised to hear it.
Yeah. So in that, this idea of being attracted to putting out that type of information, that type of misinformation to just get those clicks and views, therefore specific hits of dopamine to be released in your brain for you to feel good. You get those hits. And then once your comments slow down or your views slow down, then you're chasing that hit again. You're chasing that social media high. And then you tack on anxiety, depression, social acceptance, et cetera, et cetera. Now you have other outlying factors or internal factors, rather, that could very well have external motivations. And now you just got just a shit storm of conundrums. And that's not good for anybody involved.
All right, I hate to stop the conversation there. I do promise you that part two picks off right where part one left off, as Anthony and I really get into what he calls the war on words. And we start to really get into what role that social media and influencers are starting to play in American society in an even deeper lens. I absolutely love this conversation, and I hope you have enjoyed it too. As I said at the beginning of the episode, I would love to share with you where you can follow Anthony and where you can see a little bit more about what he's doing and what he's all about. So his handle is at iSpeak1906. He is also the author of The Purpose of Power and a spoken word artist, and his album is Metaphorically Speaking. I would highly encourage you to check out any and all of those avenues to engage with him. He has so much to give and so much to say. Thank you so much for tuning into part one. Part two, as I said, picks off right where we've left off. If you're taking a little break, please enjoy it. Stay safe out there. And thank you so much for joining me as we unpack another little chapter of America.